A spiritual awakening is taking place around the globe, and you can be a part of it. For the first time ever in human history, we are truly one world. And now we must face the implications of what that means for our understanding of spirituality, the nature of reality, and one another. As a direct descendant of the founding families of one of today's largest global religions, I was born in the center of a worldwide spiritual crisis. Like my pioneer ancestors, I'm blazing a new trail, embracing a global sense of spirituality based on personal practice, spiritual community, and direct experience of the divine. I'm Benjamin William Decker. Welcome to the Modern Spirituality Podcast. This is a great episode today. You're going to meet my buddy, Light Watkins. He is a best-selling author. He's a Vedic meditation teacher. He's taught thousands of people to meditate. And we're going to talk a little bit about his newest book, Knowing Where to Look. And this is a beautiful book. He's going to share an excerpt from the book today. And it is especially inspiring. Light and I share a few great laughs, and definitely he left me feeling super inspired. So I know that you're going to love this episode. I love it. He's a great friend of mine. I hope he'll come back again so that we can continue the fun and continue the inspiration. Welcome, Light Watkins.
Let there be light. Okay, here we are. Light Watkins, thanks for doing this, man.
Yep. And there was, and it was good.
Yep. And there's light, and it was good. Yeah. Here it is. There still is, and it's still good. It's still good. Okay. Well, I want to just start by congratulating you. You, when I first met you, it was before your first book came out. And now where you recently released, what is it? Book number?
I recently released book number three, which is Knowing Where to Look. And I'm working on book number four. The manuscript is due in a few weeks. So I'm very behind, but you know, we're going to pull through like we always do and make it happen.
Yep. I love a good deadline.
Mm-hmm. You need a deadline.
Yeah. Yeah. Deadlines are like the best boundaries for creators, for like authors and singers and songwriters and, you know, artists of all kinds.
Well, I have a great appreciation because my first book was self-published, The Inner Gym, a 30-day workout for strengthening happiness. And that one took 3.5 years to get it across the line. And and that's because I did not have a deadline until I did. I literally had to give myself a deadline. And then I knew I wasn't going to stick to it because I was trying to be really honest with myself. So I wrote a friend of mine, you know, Drew Purowit. He works with Dr. Mark Hyman. Anyway, he's a good friend of mine. I wrote him a check for $4,000, I believe, and I post-dated the check for like 2 months. And I said, and then I had a contract, I drew up a contract between me and him. And I said, if I don't turn in the manuscript for publication by such and such date, you are obligated to take this check, cash it, spend it on whatever you want. That does not include me. And so once I made that step, I had all the time in the world to write the book. You know, not having time was no longer an issue. And I ended up finishing it like a week or so early because I didn't want to take any chances on getting sick or, you know, something else happening. And I realized that, you know, discipline is not really about forcing yourself to do things. It's about putting yourself in a position where you have no other choice.
Yeah, that's huge.
And would you say that, or the downside is too detrimental to even consider it?
Right. So, would you say that that is a principle that was like infused into the writing of The Inner Gem, your first book?
Yeah, actually, yeah. It was basically six inner exercises for strengthening happiness. One was receiving, and then one was giving. And within that receiving and giving paradigm is this idea of obviously the law of exchange and the importance of making an exchange with things that you want to get value from. So, you know, writing a book was as valuable for me as it was for the reader, the whole process of it, because it's my first time really indulging in the creative process in a deep way. And, you know, when you're writing a book, as you well know, you imagine this thing's going to be out forever. So you really want it to be something that is timeless and that is poignant. And so that's one of the reasons why you can keep going on and on and on, because it's never going to be good enough. And that's why the deadline comes in handy, because it's never going to be good enough.
Absolutely. You know, for me, I'm like looking at my, I'm working on my next book. I've got a couple books out.
And, what is this for you? Number six or five or what?
Number five. Yeah. I'm working on the manuscript for number five. So I am in this very moment, I'm one book ahead of you, but you could pass me at any time. but I'm writing this one. I've had these thoughts about how I already want to rewrite the other ones. I'm already like ready for like a second edition of like Practical Meditation for Beginners. I'm already like, well, the editor really made that change and I didn't agree with that change. And this anecdote, I really didn't get, they didn't give me enough words to really go into, because I was working with a publisher who had like a very specific strategy, you know? So in one way, the only reason that even got done is because I was working with the deadlines and the structure provided by the publisher, you know? Mm-hmm. But in another way, that question is still there. Like, how could it have been better? What are the different ways that I would change it? Because it is out forever, you know, and that's what everyone says. They say, like, once you release a book, you're an author forever. You know, mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, crap, I'm going to be like 50, 60, 70, 80. And that's what I wrote. Is that really how I feel about it? I'm going to die and my great grandkid. Is this, you know, it's like you do get in your head about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that you did that I think is really interesting is that you self-published your first book and then you immediately went from self-publishing. You're like one of the success stories of self-publishing, because you self-published and then you went to, what was that little publisher that your next book came out
with? It's this tiny, I don't know if you heard about it, but it's called Random House.
Random House. Publisher. Random House, you said?
Random House, yeah.
Random House. Oh, no big deal. Only the biggest, most reputable publisher in the entire world that runs the industry. No big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I tell people will ask me, like, should I self-publish? Should I go with a publisher? And here's the deal. Like, if a publisher is not seeking you out, you're probably not going to get a great deal with pursuing a publisher. And so in a way, you self-publishing your own book is kind of like a Kickstarter for books, right? You self-publishing and marketing your own book will demonstrate to the publisher, oh, this person has marketability. That person can sell books. And that's what the publishers really care about at the end of the day. And so that'll become your calling card. And that could potentially help you get a book deal down the line. So... Mm-hmm. And also, this was before people stopped going to bookstores for the most part and started ordering books online. So if you self-publish a book these days, people don't even know the difference. If they just go online to look up your book versus any other book, they would never know that you self-published it. Considering the fact that you hired, you know, a proper designer and all of that. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. As long as it's done, you know, there is like a way to make it indistinguishable, you know, from a major publisher. You know, these major publishers, they just have people who are designers. They don't have like alien wizard channelers or something like that who are like delivering the design.
And their designers usually aren't that great, to be honest with you. They're kind of like hacks, a lot of these designers. So you could probably do a better job just outsourcing your own design team, in my experience.
Well, in my experience, there was, I would feel bad calling them hacks, because they're just like, I know them all. I know them by name who designed my book. So you guys, hey, I love you. You're not hacks. but also what I really noticed working with the publisher is, as a professional person, as a creative person, as someone with my own design aesthetic, and as the only person who knows my audience, me, you know, I would have done it differently. Mm-hmm. But having a publisher who has their own way of looking at the world, their collective way of what they want to do with it, where do they want to see it sold, how do they, you know, what are they pitting it up against? They definitely had their own opinions. And if you would have met me before my books came out, I don't think you ever would have thought I would have written the kinds of books that I ended up writing. Like the community that I was serving, the kind of people that I was around, the kind of like work that I was in, I don't think you would have expected how to self-help category books from me, you know? So I definitely can relate to the strategy. I feel like when your first book came out, when The Inner Gym came out, I think you did a book launch event at Unplug Meditation in Santa Monica. And that was like right when Unplug, it was like towards the beginning of Unplug's like incarnation. It was like a newer place. And it was like this new sexy studio. And who's this super hot meditation teacher? Light Watkins. Wow. What a scene. And I remember thinking like, wow, this is a really unique approach to meditation. Unplug has its own uniqueness, but The Inner Gym was very much like it had its own personality and relationship to meditation. It was very relatable and it was very particular, but it wasn't like over emphasis on like consciousness or spirituality or the 5D or, you know, some of these things that we hear a lot about. What was your... And I know that you had an exploration of consciousness, you know, before that. So what was your decision? Because for me, when Practical Meditation for Beginners was on my plate, and that's what I was writing and creating, I was kind of like, I kind of want to go more esoteric. I kind of want to go more creative. I kind of want to go in another direction. But you actually self-published and made that decision on your own. You could have self-published anything. You could have written it in any possible way, in any direction. And that's what you chose. So what was going through your mind in that process that caused you to go that direction?
Well, I've always considered myself to be a sort of meat and potatoes meditation guy, you know, not very complicated, not trying to sound, you know, more esoteric than necessary and all of that. And so I kind of established myself as the person who simplifies these kinds of practices. And that's became my gold standard is how can I cut out as much of the fat as possible while retaining the essence of the practice so that someone who is a burger flipper, someone who is a truck driver can come across this book and not dismiss it as, oh, this is woo-woo nonsense, but this is actually real world practical. This has lots of value for me. And so that was my operating principle, is to make it valuable for the every man. And in order to do that, you have to use very real life examples and, you know, leave a lot of the things out that maybe if you were writing a book specifically for the spiritual community, then you would probably add in a bunch of stuff. But, you know, there's this restaurant here in Mexico City where I am. It's called Los Lucers. And it's funny because I went there a few times and I ordered some taco dishes and stuff and, you know, very carne. I don't speak a lot of Spanish, so I was just ordering like carne this and bistec that. And these were all meat dishes, meat tacos. And I'm not a vegetarian, right? I used to be a vegetarian, but now I'm not a vegetarian. So I really enjoyed the meals. And then on the third time there, I ran into a friend of mine who then enlightened me to the fact that this is a plant-based restaurant. I was like, no way. I've had meat here. What are you talking about? He goes, no, that was, you didn't have any meat here. Those were mushrooms or whatever they right. used. And then I ended up speaking with the owner. In fact, I interviewed the owner, Mariana Blanco, for my podcast. And she said her whole mission is she's not catering to vegetarians and vegans. She's catering to meat eaters who may think that they're having a certain experience when in actuality they're having a different experience. And so that reminds me of sort of my approach to meditation and these other practices is I want people who aren't even really looking for meditation to come across this book and read it and go, oh, wow. Not only do I think I can do that, I want to do that. I want to have that experience. So that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah, I love that. And clearly it's resonated with a lot of different people, helped a lot of different people. And so bringing us into that book that you had a publisher with, what was the name of the publisher again?
Random House.
Anyway,
exactly. So easy to forget, Random House.
I just want to emphasize what a huge achievement that is. You know, you went from self-publishing your first book. You're not someone who self-published out of nowhere, though. You did have a career over a number of years. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of integrity in that career. You were very committed to that career. It's not like you had a career shift. You changed what you were doing. You had a new idea and came out with a book. There was a whole foundation that it was built on.
Yeah, I'd been teaching meditation for 10 years at that point. And here's what the point I was making earlier was I'd just done a TED talk, which did really well. I think it got like 800 something thousand views and a TEDx talk. Mm-hmm. And I had my self-published book out. And I started doing all these workshops and retreats around the world. And I started the Shine Movement. Mm-hmm. And with the Shine Movement, you know, I'm not a drinker. I'm not sober either, but I don't identify as someone who drinks, like meaning I may drink once a year or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. In a celebratory environment or whatever. But so I had this event called The Shine, which we talked about on my podcast, where it's like an inspirational variety show. And just one little aspect of it is there's no alcohol being served. So, you know, the hypothesis is that adults can and oftentimes want to get together without needing alcohol to escape from whatever's going on and to be able to connect in a very healthy and inspirational environment. So this went on for 5 years. It started in Los Angeles. We expanded it to New York, expanded it to London, you know, and then just started expanding from there. And it just so happened to coincide with this idea or this movement of sober fun for adults. Mm-hmm. And we got a call from the New York Times. They want to do a profile of The Shine. And so I'm talking about, oh, okay. Well, yeah, it's an inspirational variety show. We have people come and give these like TED talk type of things. We meditate. Like I was all into the idea. It's really a meditation party with some music and comedy and talks sprinkled in. And then I just, as an aside, oh, yeah, we don't drink anything either. And the whole article ended up being about how it was a sober event. Mm-hmm. And I was initially disappointed by that. Because I thought that was just that
you were disappointed by your New York Times article. Is that what you said?
Yeah, but by the fact that they focused on something that wasn't even really the biggest selling point to me
for you
as the founder of this movement. And but because it was featured in the New York Times, a lot of other media outlets picked it up, and then basically we were covered by every major news outlet because that was incredible. The hot topic was sober fun. And so then publishers and agents were seeking me out, and that was my point. Once they seek you out, I showed my agent the same book proposal that got rejected by the Crowns and the Random Houses and all of these places 2 or 3 years before. It's the same proposal, except the only difference is my platform had gotten bigger. There were more mentions of me when people Googled my name. And so all of a sudden, oh my God, this is an amazing, oh, you want to write a book about meditation specifically, how to succeed in meditation without really trying, blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, I got that. We took the proposal to bid and we got like 9 offers and Random House wow. gave us the most attractive offer. But we got a lot of offers from a lot of other publishing houses, very reputable publishing houses. And it was a very exciting time. But it taught me that you need to come to the table with marketability, with a way to sell books, because that's primarily what these publishers are interested in. They don't really care about the idea as much if your right. platform isn't big enough to be able to sell lots and lots of books and potentially even become a bestseller.
Right. Right. So that's such an important thing for anyone who's wanting to come up with a book. The book does not create your platform. Mm-mm. Especially if you're wanting to get like a good deal at a publishing house, you know, it doesn't create your platform. The book like benefits from your platform. The book needs a platform mm-hmm. to stand on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if your idea is too unique, it could be the best idea in the world, but they're not going to want to publish it. It needs to fit into what's already selling. That's what they're going to want to publish. And that's if you have a platform. So that's why I say the best course of action for a new author with no platform and a unique idea is self-publish your book and show the market demand for it. And that's what happened with the top 5 regrets of the dying. You know, when Bronnie Ware wrote that book, it was a self-published book. It went viral. And then she got some big publisher to redistribute it and ended up selling like millions of copies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of different stories and examples of that where a book was originally self-published and then it has like a re-release.
Mm-hmm. Young Pueblo's first book.
Mm-hmm. And he's super viral. Yeah.
He and self-published that book and it went and sold, and they republished it and it sold a lot of copies.
So the thing that I would want to emphasize is that you were not brand new. You didn't have 0 students. You had been teaching for 10 years, like you said. So there were a lot of people who had been practicing with you or who had been initiated into their practice by you for a while. Before you wrote that book. So even though you needed an even bigger platform, some of the biggest media outlets in the world, like New York Times, to get the second book deal, to even have a respectable, strong release of that first one, there was a real career there. So I think a lot of times people come to me, they want to write a book and they have like this vague idea. And what they really want to write a book about is something that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what I am always emphasizing is when you are an author of something, author has like that same root word as authority. Mm-hmm. So maybe not something that you're interested in right now, but something that
you're an expert
authority over. Yeah. Something that you've developed some level of expertise in. Mm-hmm. Like what you did. Okay. So there's the first 2 books, Inner Gym, Bliss More. And then here we are, like, let's talk about Knowing Where to Look. I love the title. I actually really like the design of it. How do you feel about your design? You made a design comment.
This book, Knowing Where to Look, is what I loved about this book project. I did it with Sounds True, who's a publisher out of Boulder, Colorado. They did a lot of Eckhart Tolle books and Michael Bernard Beckwith books and those kinds of books. Wayne Dyer's Hay House. And they gave me, I didn't know to ask for this initially, but they gave me full creative license in the negotiation stage. So I knew to ask for, because I didn't have that with the other book with Random House. And that was that's why I'm calling designers hacks, because they just basically rammed this design down my throat. And I think it's a nice design. It's just not the design I would have chosen had I had it up to me. And, you know, and they kind of went with the safe route, They went the safe route. And the version that you see now is nice, but we had to get to that version. The first version, I was actually shocked. I was like, this is like some high school kid who designed this, who took one week of design class. Mm-hmm. I can't believe this is coming out of the biggest publishing house in the world.
Right.
So, cause I'm a design guy, I've been a graphic designer. I've worked as a graphic designer in my life before, and I'm really design focused. And, so it was really important to me for the book to look a certain way. And yeah, so we spent a lot of time, when we were going through and designing, knowing where to look, because the design plays a role in the experience with the reader, in the sense that this is a book of doses of inspiration, 108 daily doses of inspiration. And it's meant to be flipped open to any page. And then that page will have one dose of inspiration on it. And so oftentimes the way the page is actually laid out and designed tells the story of that dose of inspiration. And sometimes there are even Easter eggs that are hidden inside of the design. So yeah, it took a lot of very intentional design, going back and forth with the illustrators, with the art directors. And it was a really nice team. And it's something that I don't know if I'll be able to replicate, but I'm really proud of it. I'm really, really proud of this, which is exactly how I want it to feel. And I actually played a role in designing the cover as well, which is nice.
Love that. Yeah, I love the entire design of this one. This is one you definitely want to get
in hard copy,
hands on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, hard copy versus like an ebook. This is it's a lot more of a handheld experience to have out. And it has that kind of like Oracle kind of quality where it's like, what does the universe have for me synchronistically as I flip through this?
Right. Well, you actually, when I was telling you about this, when we were still in the conception phase, you had a term for it. Starts with a B,
bibliomancy. It's so funny. I keep thinking that word and I'm like, no, I don't need to say bibliomancy.
Bibliomancy means something, a book or something you can open up to at any page and get a message from.
Essentially, yeah. Like cartomancy is like the sister word where you like use like tarot cards or you shuffle a deck. Mm-hmm. Necromancy is like when you do a seance and you communicate with the dead. And so bibliomancy is when you like use a book for divination or divine inspiration, specifically opening it to any page.
So do you know this because you studied Latin or because of your religious background, or just you're just a nerd like that?
I'm just all of it. Yeah. Like I have studied Latin. I do have a religious background. I am a nerd. So yes to that multiple choice question. D, all of the above. Okay. Yeah. So kind of all, I don't remember learning that, it's one of those things that's like you learned it at some point and like it exists in your awareness. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, it's a really interesting concept. Like we're kind of used to Oracle card decks. Mm-hmm. And so the concept of cartomancy is there. People don't really call it that as much, but that's like what they call it in the, in like the comparative religious academic world. That's what they call it. Mm-hmm. So I guess technically I probably did learn that word like at a Harvard comparative religion course, I think, now that I think about it, but the interesting thing with bibliomancy is that like you could pick up the Bible, you could pick up any book that's not designed that way and just sort of like set an intention and open the book to any page and see what kind of inspiration you can glean from it. There's that expression, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. It doesn't necessarily mean that a literal teacher is going to be like, bum, ba, da, bum, you're ready now, here I am. It's of course more of an expression of like, when you're ready, you're going to see the lesson. Mm-hmm. When the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And if you're watching a cartoon, or if you're on a date, or if you're reading a book, the lesson will have its like materialization because of your readiness, you know, because like the state of your mental readiness, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what it's all like based on. And so with your book, do you have like any kind of recommendation for an intention setting or anything like in the introduction around that for when you pick it up?
Not really. I really wanted it to feel, you know, quotes random, even though if we pan back a little bit, we kind of know that there's no such thing as randomnicity. It's kind of what Einstein said, either you think everything is random or everything is a miracle. And mm-hmm. so I like for people to feel like, yeah, it's random, but then you open it up and it's the exact message that you needed to read in that moment. And then that gives more evidence to this idea that maybe things aren't as random as I thought they were. And right. so then that's why it's called Knowing Where to Look, because through experiencing the book, because it's not even just reading it, it's an experience. Through experiencing the book, you start to change or shift in your perception of what you consider reality to be. And it often expands beyond, you know, what most people feel like their reality or what life is about. And it expands to include, you know, things that you thought were throwaway moments or in between moments that didn't matter very much, but actually everything delivered a gift or a teaching or a lesson, because it prepped you to be able to see the materialization of it.
So can we flip through it right now and get a quick read for this moment?
Yep. So I'm not even going to look. I'm just going to flip.
Okay. This is for you. This is for me. This is for everyone listening through time and space at any time. All right. So listen up, everyone.
Okay. Here we go. Okay. Here we go. This is called Everything is an Illusion. Everything is an illusion. Hmm. A devotee heard his guru say that everything in life was an illusion. So on his way home, the man saw a wild elephant stampeding through a small village. He stood frozen with fear as the elephant began coming in his direction. Everybody ducked and dove out of the way. A shopkeeper saw the devotee standing in the middle of the road and yelled for him to move out of the way of the elephant. But remembering what his beloved guru said about everything being an illusion, the devotee thought, perhaps this is his guru's way of testing his faith. That elephant is probably an illusion. A few seconds later, the elephant trampled the man pretty badly, sending him to the hospital. When the guru came to check on him, the devotee grew very angry. I thought you said that everything in life was an illusion, but that elephant was real. The elephant actually was an illusion, replied the wise guru. And so was that shopkeeper who warned you to get out of the way.
Wow.
So imagine if you're floating in orbit around the Earth and looking down at the vast blue ocean. From that high up, you wouldn't be able to make out any of the ocean's individual waves. In fact, from that high up, the ocean would appear rather stagnant, not fluid. But to someone swimming in the ocean, it would feel anything but stagnant. And if both parties reported on what the nature of the ocean was, stagnant or fluid, who would be correct? Both. The ocean is both stagnant and fluid at the same time, depending on your vantage point. Similarly, saying that life is both real and an illusion depends on which vantage point you're referring to. From the spiritual perspective or from the ground level perspective. One perspective does not cancel out the other. Instead, they complement one another. The spiritual perspective reminds us that everything is connected, while the ground level perspective allows us to be fully immersed in the human experience. The idea is to live both simultaneously.
Boom.
So somebody needed to hear that.
Yeah, I think maybe I did. the idea is to live both simultaneously. What a powerful way to wrap that dose up.
Mm. And by the way, I didn't come up with that story. That's a classic story that's been told. So some of the doses of inspiration are adopted from classic stories that have been told in spiritual circles for thousands of years. And some of them are personal stories, things that actually happened to me, but all of them sort of have a lesson at the end that gives us a different way to look at life.
Yeah, I love that. What would your recommendation be, or what do you have to say about what would it mean to really live in both of those places at once? Like everything's real and everything's an illusion.
Well, you know, we live in a society that places a lot of emphasis on what's real, what's quotes real, right? What's real life. Mm-hmm. And they see practices like meditation and gratitude and, you know, Reiki and things like this that are less tangible. They see them as extracurricular, you know, mm-hmm. like back when you were in school, you may take math, science, you know, social studies. These kinds of classes were seen as the tenets of a proper education, right? And then a class like sewing or typing, or, you know, these were extracurricular classes, which means you don't need them to graduate. You don't need them to be successful in the world necessarily. Although I have to say, typing is the one class I still use every day from high school. So who would have thought that?
Yeah, me too. Those like finger placements, like.
Yeah, that's right. I don't have to look at the keyboard at all. But yeah. We need to get our spiritual practices out of the extracurricular activity category, put them in the primary activity category, right alongside of math, science, social studies, geography, and all the things that we thought were so important, because it ends up informing the choices that we make in life, you know, and very important choices such as, am I going to date this person? Am I going to get engaged with this person? Am I going to marry this person? Am I going to take this job versus that job? And why? You know, is it because they're paying me more money, or is it because I am able to be more creative? Right. So all of these considerations are either being sourced externally or they're being sourced internally. And when we can source them internally, we typically make better choices, more sustainable choices, choices that enliven that sense of passion and wonder inside of us, as opposed to draining that sense of passion and wonder in an effort to acquire an experience that we think will hopefully maybe lead to some degree of happiness down the line after we achieve whatever the experience is. That is an exercise in futility that a lot of times we don't realize it's an exercise in futility until we're in our middle age, until we're in our 40s or 50s. And that's why they say we have a midlife crisis, because we're waking up to the fact that, hey, I've achieved all the things. I became a millionaire. I got the big house. I got the nice car. I got the beautiful trophy wife or successful husband. And I don't feel any different inside. In fact, I feel worse, because I feel like my life has just kind of passed me by. And I was just an observer of it, as opposed to an active participant in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a lot of really good big life lessons. You'd mm-hmm. probably be amazing to process one-on-one with. You know, if someone's going through something, you probably have a lot of really helpful things, helpful insights, especially to an open person, someone who's in like that cynical state. It's like we were saying earlier, if the student's ready, the teacher will appear. It's like, if you're closed-minded, you're not going to receive it. You're going to hear that story about the stampede of elephants and be like, that's not helpful for me, because what is my negative bank account an illusion? Is my divorce an illusion? And it's like, yes. Okay. Well, that's not helping me right now. You know, there's like a cynical perspective that would literally block wisdom. But to an open-minded person, there's a lot of really, really wonderful things that you're saying. What I'm getting at is, you've written these books, you've helped a lot of people. The act of writing a book is actually enriching, because you do a lot of research, you really, you know, test some of your own material, test your own ideas. So a lot of learning happens in the act of writing a book. Working with thousands of clients, as you have over the last several years that you've been in this field, each client that you're working with, you learn, there's like a nuance that comes in, you develop the experience that only comes with direct experience, working with all these different thousands of people. But how did you, even before that, at the very beginning, How did you become a meditation teacher, and how did you, like, what was the path that you took to initiate into that work?
I was a yoga teacher, a full-time yoga teacher, for a few years, and I was a meditation dabbler. I was a reluctant meditator. And the reason is because I didn't have any formal instruction, and meditation was very challenging for me. You know, like a lot of people that I work with today, you know, they come into the rooms thinking they have a monkey mind, their mind won't get quiet. My mind is sabotaging meditation. It's too hard, you know, all of this stuff. And that was my experience. And one of my yoga teacher mentors invited me to come and hear his meditation teacher give a presentation on meditation. And it ended up being transcendental meditation. I didn't know anything about transcendental meditation. I didn't know there were different forms of meditation. But I really connected with the accessibility of that particular path. And at the same time, I really connected with the teacher. And I knew almost instantly, like within 10 minutes, that I was meant to be a meditation teacher. I didn't know how it was going to happen. We're talking about 2003 now. So there was no YouTube. There were no meditation apps. There was nothing other than books and the Bodhi Tree, bookstore.
I miss the Bodhi Tree.
Yeah. And they used to have little seminars and stuff in their little theater room.
Right. The annex.
I would go to the Beverly Hills Library and I would check out various books on astral traveling and channeling and, you know, things like that. And that was how I learned about some of these practices, crop circles. I was really into all of the esoteric stuff. And, when I met my teacher, I just knew that I felt like I had just come home and started working with him. And then about 4 years later, he said, "Hey, I'm taking some of my proteges, of which I was one, over to India to train you all to become meditation teachers if you would like that." And so I jumped at the chance. I didn't have a whole lot of money at the time. I was teaching yoga full time, so I was only making probably $800 or $900 a week. After taxes,
which is more than a lot of yoga instructors.
Yeah, that's true. I was teaching like 10 or 12 classes a week. I was teaching all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, but the training in India, it was $14,000. So I only had a couple thousand dollars saved up, and, you know, you had to pay the whole thing to start. I'm going to cut the long story short, but I had been dabbling in real estate because I had really good credit. So that was back in 2006, where they were just giving mortgages away to anyone who had good credit. No, zero interest or zero money down, interest only mortgages. So I did one of those against my intuition. I did it and it all ended up crashing down a couple of years later. But because I had done that, I was getting these cash advance offers in the bank and in the mail. And one was from some bank offering me $14,000 cash advance, zero interest for 18 months. And then after that, you have to pay this exorbitant interest amount. And my training was only going to be 3 or 4 months. So I figured, okay, this is perfect. I'll use it for the training. It came in the 11th hour. So it was like, I had no idea how I was going to make this training happen. And then and then that thing came in the mail, and I just felt like this is what I'm supposed to do. So I used it for the training, and sure enough, went away 4 months, came back, started working as a meditation teacher, and I was actually able to pay it off within about a month and a half, 2 months. I paid it all off. So it all worked out. And the story I tell today, and in fact, I have a story about it in this book, Knowing Where to Look, is that if I had chosen not to do that because I was listening to the financial gurus of the world, I would have been correct. I would have been 100% correct. And I probably would have a story that I tell today about how I almost was gullible enough to take one of those predatory loans But thank God I didn't do it. And I saved up my money and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But instead, I get to tell this story, which is a much more adventurous and inspirational story of listening to your heart, taking a leap of faith, not knowing how it's going to turn out, but knowing that you're leaping in a direction of something that faith, that makes you feel expansive and that you're willing to put your all into. And it all worked out beautifully. And I ended up writing a book about it. So I mean, it couldn't be any better than that.
Yeah. And I love the way that you're framing that. It's like, they're both great decisions.
Yeah, that's the dichotomy. That's the real and the illusion. You
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's really important when we're faced with challenging decisions. The way that I sometimes think about it is like, you know, being raised Christian, a lot of times I think about it like God doesn't care. Mm-hmm. God hasn't determined which one's a better move. You get to have like creative control over this decision. You know, it's like a creative decision where it doesn't really matter if you used blue or if you used purple. It's mm-hmm. a creative decision. Up to you. Do you want to use orange or do you want to use red? It's a creative move. So there was like a with your life being the art project in this context, you made the creative decision to take that risk. You know, you, was that your first time going to India?
It was, yeah.
And so, you know, there was some part of you that was like, you know what, this is a yes. Like you said, when you 10 minutes in, 4 years before that, mm-hmm. 10 minutes in to learning how to meditate, you had been a dabbler, like you said, but 10 minutes in to learning how to meditate, you're like, I'm going to teach this. So not only am I going to learn this and actually practice it, I'm going to teach this. And that's something interesting. Like a lot of times people will come meditate for the first time and they're like, I want to become a meditation teacher. And I always say, yes, I want you to become a meditation teacher. Talk to me after 1 year of daily meditation. And then we'll talk mm-hmm. about the next step.
mm-hmm. I do the same thing. People say that to me. I'm like, okay, fine. Talk to me. I say 2 years. I
say, oh yeah. 2 years. Good. And then after 1 year, it's like, okay, now we'll do it again.
Yeah, do it again. Yeah, they don't want to hear that.
Yeah, no. And this, and like, what's really interesting is for the last several years, I've been doing psychedelic preparation and integration. So mm-hmm. in a medically overseen, medically licensed context, with the first ever organization to offer it from a medical standpoint. Which is amazing that now that it's exploding and growing in so many wonderful ways. But I'll take people through the preparation. They'll have the psychedelic experience. And then we do an integration process where, you know, we plan once a week beforehand. And then the day beforehand, it's like workshops all day. Then the next day there's workshops all day for like a week. And then we're together once a week for like 3 months after that. And then they are in normal therapy. And so probably at least 20% of the time, someone will have their first experience ever with like ayahuasca or with a plant medicine. And then the next day they'll be like, I'm supposed to be a shaman. And it's like, let me just bring you back to the mantra, you know, like come back to the moment. Right now we're processing your life, you know, mm-hmm. and it's kind of like going to therapy one time and being like, damn, I want to be a therapist, you know? And so this is another one of the ways where you are, a rarity. You're a success story, you know, someone coming in to their first ever meditation instruction, maybe mm-hmm. like, you know, if it was transcendental meditation, then you were probably in the free intro to meditation, 1 hour session or whatever mm-hmm. it is. And, having that thought, I want to be a meditation teacher in that mm-hmm. moment of all the people that have that thought, it's like 1 in 1,000 who actually get to do it, you know, mm-hmm. of all the people who then later self-publish a book, it's way less than one in a thousand. It's more like one in a million who then get a major publishing deal after that. You know, sort of to jump around a little bit, when we talked about you getting that major publishing deal, and you talked about the publicity that helped expand your platform that got you the Random House deal. I know I'm totally jumping back. There was something about that that I thought was interesting. My background, my professional background, was in PR. And what would happen all the time is people would have nothing going on. They would be doing nothing. They would say, I am a life coach and I need a publicist. And they would have no projects, no events, you know, and they would say, I want to be in the New York Times. You know, so they're a meditation teacher, they're a yoga instructor, they've somehow got the money for a publicist. And it's the reality is you can't pay for that kind of publicity. Mm-hmm. No matter how much you're paying, you would have to be paying like major, major money to a major well-connected person to get that level of publicity. So you didn't just buy the publicity out of nowhere. You were actively creating and mm-hmm. serving out in the world, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. through, and the Shine, look, guys, I was there for at least the planning of at least two of those, which you've done so many more times than two, right? I don't even, mm-hmm. how many times would you say, how many?
I probably did like, maybe like six dozen.
Wow, okay. So like nearly 100, if we're going to mm-hmm. round to the nearest 100, nearly 100 of these events. And look, I was in the process of at least two. Mm-hmm. And I think about two of them that I experienced. And it's a whole shebang. It's a lot of work. Yeah, it's a whole production. It's a lot of work. The preparation for it is a lot of work. The marketing for it is a lot of work. The execution of it requires a lot of precision, a lot of strategy, a lot of different people, a lot of moving parts. So it's not like you got lucky and got all that mm-hmm. publicity. You really clocked the time mm-hmm. and put in the consistency and the effort. And you know what we call that? Earning it. Mm-hmm. You know, you actually went through the process to earn it. You didn't buy it. You earned mm-hmm. it. And that kind of PR cannot be bought. And that's why your platform genuinely grew. You can't hire a publicist for a few months or even a year and expect that your platform is going to grow to that level mm-hmm. without being, you might get a really great publicist who says, you need to be doing something, sweetheart. Why don't we talk about something you can go do? You might get a publicist who has like that visionary consciousness who can help you come up with your version of the Shine. Mm-hmm. That matches you, you know, but you can't really buy it, you know, and so that's what's really, really interesting to me about you is like there's Light Watkins, meditation teacher, but there's also Light Watkins, tenacious, consistent professional. You are someone who I've always seen be, first of all, extremely consistent with whatever you're up to. And it's always very, very high quality. So your own standards are very high. Your discipline and willingness to continue to go through the process is very commendable. And when you had that, it's not like you came out with that self-published book and didn't do anything. You had a plan. I don't know what the plan was, but as a professional who's come out with my own books, I look and I can just tell he knows what he's doing. You had a plan for getting the book out. You had a plan for sharing the book with people for, you know, distribution on some kind of level. And so every step of the way, someone might say, wow, overnight success. He had a self-published book, and then he was with Random House, endorsed by Deepak Chopra, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. Blissmore has like a Deepak Chopra endorsement on the front mm-hmm. cover, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Not freaking bad, you know, not bad, you know. And where are you from? Are you from Atlanta? Is that right?
Montgomery, Alabama.
That's right.
Yeah.
So not bad for a boy
from Alabama. Montgomery.
Alabama. Yeah. Not too bad, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a really, really cool thing. Like your consistency and I wouldn't even my energy, the energy sense that I get on it is that it's not really even ambition so much as purpose.
Yeah, man. I just wanted to serve. And, you know, that Deepak quote, it came from a relationship I had with Deepak's daughter who came, who I got to come to the shine and do a meditation. And so then we became friendly, you know, and she was like, if there's any way I can help you out, let me know. And I was like, oh, actually, I have this manuscript. I need an endorsement from your dad. You think you can help out with that? And she did. So, wow. You know, it all comes back to service. That's really the root of it all. And I think that's the point you're making is that everything good that has happened that people have heard about really didn't start there. It started with some intention to want to give back. Even this book, Knowing Where to Look, this is the culmination of over 5 years of writing a daily dose of inspiration email and sending it out to my list. Mm-hmm. Why did I start doing that? Because I felt insecure as a writer when I was writing Bliss More. When I got my first proper book deal, I was like, oh my God, I should get a ghostwriter. Right. Because that's what happens a lot of time in the publishing industry. You get people like Kevin Hart or, you know, these celebrities who have these best-selling books. They didn't write these books. They got the help of a ghostwriter. Someone, Neil Strauss actually wrote Kevin Hart's book. Neil Strauss is a 12-time best-selling New York Times best-selling author. So, of course, when he writes, Mark Manson wrote Will Smith's book. Will Smith didn't write his book. He told his story to Mark Manson, who wrote The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And then he wrote Will Smith's book, which has also become, you know, a bestseller multiple times over. And so I knew that that's how it worked. And I was like, I want to use some of my advance money to get a ghostwriter, someone who that's all they do is write bestsellers. And I'll tell them the story. And my agent persuaded me to write the book myself. She said, you don't really need a ghostwriter. And I was like, oh shit. Well, I need to get better at writing then, because it took me 3.5 years to write the first book. And this is, I only have 6 months to write this book. And so I have less time to write. And so what can I do? Oh, I'll put myself through my own self-imposed writing gym, you know, kind of like the inner gym. So I brought that into it. And I was like, the best way to do that is to write something every day. And to have to do it, put a deadline on it. Okay, it goes out at 6 a.m. Pacific time every morning and make it public so that you have to really pay attention, because people will let you know if you're being offensive, insensitive, you know, and I've heard it all. And so that was the birth of the Daily Dose of Inspiration. I wanted the book to be inspirational. I had no idea that it would turn into a book. I was just writing to practice writing. I was giving inspiration to practice writing. And then after thousands upon thousands upon thousands of daily inspirational emails, waking up every morning at 5 o'clock, spending 2 hours writing and all of that, I had this archive of these beautifully written, honed little 200 word inspirational stories, anecdotes, vignettes. And then I was having a conversation with my agent after Bliss More came out, and we were like, let's do something with that. I mean, they're wonderful. You get a lot of feedback when you send them out. And so that culminated in Knowing Where to Look, 108 Daily Doses of Inspiration. So everything that I've done really has been a byproduct of just wanting to help people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And so it's like coming from that altruistic energy that actually infuses itself in the content as it comes out. Because when I hear it and when I experience it, it's like, it's not about you. It's about me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm reading Light Watkins' book. And even if you're talking about an experience that Light Watkins had, it's about me. I'm experiencing it about me, about my life, you know? And so as someone who's like mega psychic, me, when I'm reading it, I can tell that you had that intention. I can tell that you were trying to help me, the reader. And that is what creates longevity in this kind of career. Mm-hmm. You know, that is what creates the return customer. That's what causes someone to buy the entire library of Light Watkins books, you know, the fact that it's legitimately helpful.
Yeah. And I also wanted it to be timeless. So there's actually, the funny thing about my books is that I don't read them after they come out usually. So I can't think of anything I would change in any of the books because they're actually written to be read 200 years from now, you know, mm-hmm. by some kid in whatever the version of the library is 200 years from now. But right. In order to be as helpful then as it is now. And right. and I've had that standard pretty much the whole time as well. So,
yeah. And that's one of the mistakes I made is reading them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I could have shared this story instead of that one. Why did I share that one? You know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a great way to do it. Is like once it's released to like, it's a form of being present, I think. Mm-hmm. Because as the writer, the book's already out, so there's the book's sort of like in the past for the author.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm Gladwell talks about that in his masterclass on that mm-hmm. platform masterclass. He says once you mm-hmm. release a book, it's no longer yours; it's the public's. And right. so you know you're just going to drive yourself crazy thinking about all the things you do differently because they're going to totally. Take it just like they took his 10,000 hour rule. Quote and completely twisted it out of context and made it into something that he wasn't even intending to point that he wasn't even intending to make. But that's what happens, you know, it becomes theirs. And so you just let him roll with it.
Right. You know, and I hear Marianne Williamson also talk about there's a quote and when you mm-hmm. hear her talk about it, it's very different than when you hear someone else talk about it. Mm-hmm. I remember one time I was working on her presidential campaign. We were, you know, getting her a lot of publicity. And someone said, I love your poem. And Marianne doesn't write poems, you know. Right. They were like, I love your poem. Our greatest fear is not that we're inadequate. It's that we're powerful beyond measure. Mm-hmm. And Marianne was like, well, it's actually not a poem. It's just a quote from one of my books. And it wasn't even a particularly important quote, you know, it's just like a part of,
and that's what she's like known for in the greater in the general market is that quote, you know, between yeah. her. Did Nelson Mandela say it? Did Marianne Williams say it?
Yeah, controversy there's like a whole, around it. There's a whole urban legend around that quote and mm-hmm. what it means, and apparently a bunch of people think it's a poem, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like when you find the source of it, it's actually. In the context, she's like explaining this. It's very much part of a personal anecdote. It's very much like in the context of an experience, you know, but you're right. It becomes.
Oh, wait. So she didn't say it. That was a quote that she used in one of her books.
No, she said it. It's a Marianne okay. Williamson quote. Got yeah. It. It's her information, but she's communicating those words.
Got it. To make a greater point.
Yeah. To make a greater point. And mm-hmm. And it ties a few things sort of like in a little bow. It like ties mm-hmm. things together. Mm-hmm. But you kind of got to read three pages to like really get the whole thing. And it, of course, does stand alone. It has its mm-hmm. own message as it stands alone, you know. But it's it is interesting to your point that once you write something, it's not yours anymore. It's kind of like giving birth. You know, we mm-hmm. a lot of times we hear that expression. When you write a book, you've given birth. That kid is going to go do whatever that kid wants now. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as, you know, my parents wanted me to go on a Mormon mission when I was 19, come back 2 years later, meet a nice Mormon girl, marry her, then graduate from BYU and, you know, live and then have five little Mormon kids who all do the same thing. It's like, that baby had a life of its own and like went out into the world and kind of is doing, you know, not quite that, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I love that. And I think that this whole conversation has ended up really becoming super helpful, especially for, I think a lot of the listeners are creators and mm-hmm. they are people who maybe in their lives are really inspiring for other people. And I think that there's a special thing when you're naturally inspirational. You have a natural inclination, maybe through the challenges that you've been through, things that you've overcome, and you have like that natural, you're the natural oracle of the community. Your friends come to you. You're sort of a natural. Maybe you've become a therapist. Maybe you've become a yoga instructor. Maybe you've become a meditation teacher. I think that what I've always respected about your work, like as someone who kind of came on the scene a heartbeat after you, I feel like we're kind of like in the same little class, but maybe you like graduated a couple of years ahead of me, but like we were in school at the same time or something. What I see, cause I've always looked up to you. And what I appreciate, the thing that I think anyone who's looking up to us now, it's all about that real connection to the purpose of really being of genuine service. Mm-hmm. And then living in ongoing consistency from that place. Mm-hmm. That's what I get from you. It's like I don't feel like you fake it. I don't feel like you're not over here hiding the fact that you eat meat or whatever. You know, it's like I feel like you're very much your own person. There's never been like a narrative around you being celibate, or I've never really felt like the vegan thing was like part of your teaching, and you're sort of like, to use Ruby Warrington's phrase, sober curious, but maybe not quite sober curious, but just sort of like not much of a drinker and not really much of a substance person. Mm-hmm. But also not with like a hard boundary against it, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're very much like a well-balanced person. Mm-hmm. Who maintains like that inner sense of integrity, and it expresses into all of your work, you know? So I think that there's like the things that we are actively teaching by what we choose to write and what we choose to say. And then mm-hmm. there are the things that we're teaching by who we are.
There's this beautiful Gandhi anecdote where he was on some train and this journalist was trying to get a quote from him. And he was running alongside of the train. Gandhi, I guess, was at the window, and he said, "Can you give me a quote, please, to publish in the paper? What's your message for today?" And Gandhi said, "My life is my message." You know,
and I feel like that's a huge quote.
Yeah, I feel like that's true for all of us. But I really appreciate that reflection because I haven't thought about it in that way, but it's true. I've written about and talked about how your greatest editor is being clear about your purpose. When you're really crystal clear about your purpose and you're not distracting yourself away from your purpose by trying to find happiness outside of yourself, then it really allows you to be very clear about what to edit out. And really, you know, your greatness, I'm speaking to just people in general, your greatness is already inside of you. And it's just about chipping away at the stuff that's not reflective of your purpose. And that's where your greatness will just kind of unfold. And it will be beautiful for you. You know, someone else will reflect back to you in the way that you just reflected back to me of, oh, wow, this is what you've been up to in these since I've known you. And, you know, you and I haven't really had a whole lot of conversations like this. So I had no idea you were even paying that close of attention to what I was doing, but it's, you know, somebody's always paying attention. And even if you don't think anyone is, somebody is. And so another thing I've said before that I think is helpful is it doesn't matter what you think your priorities are. If you really want to know what your priorities are, ask your friends, because they see the people who are closest to you will know, oh yeah, John meditates every day, or Ben drinks lots of water every day. That's his priority. Like if someone were to ask your closest friends, what are your three biggest priorities? They would tell what the real priorities are. And so if you want to change your priorities, then you need to start doing them, being a person of action, so much so that the people around you, they just know, oh, you get up early, or you meditate every day, or you don't drink a lot of alcohol, or you whatever. Because we have a tendency to kind of lie to ourselves and hide out in our blind spots and delude ourselves into thinking that what we want to do is what we're actually doing, when that's oftentimes not the case.
Mm, So true. As you're saying that, I'm like, okay, so I'm going to ask Anna Lynn and Saw and Ansley and Marianne and David what my priorities are.
They would know. I guarantee you they would know.
Yeah. And what a great self-evaluation for like someone who you really love to honestly answer that, for you to just have like that sober, fearless reflection. Yeah. I really love that. And this has been amazing. I really appreciate who you are and how you show up in the world. I've totally been, you know, a huge fan of your work and everything you're up to. And you just continue to affirm that part of me that wants you to be who I think you are. And you just keep proving me right. So thank you for how you show up in the world.
Thank you, brother. It's a pleasure connecting with you as always.
Yeah. And one thing that I want to say in closing about that comes up for me when I hear that phrase, knowing where to look, the title of your third book, your newest book, Knowing Where to Look. When I was studying Kabbalah, I did a 4-year stint, I guess you could say, in a deep dive in Kabbalah. And it was always taught that the rabbi will tell us where to dig and what to dig for. Mm-hmm. But the digging we must do ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so that's what comes up for me. And that's what I love about knowing where to look is like, mm-hmm. this is where to look, mm-hmm. but you have to look. Mm-hmm.
Beautifully said.
Yeah, I love that. Okay. So I'll make sure to get all your links in the show notes here. So everyone listening, check it out. Follow Light Watkins, follow all his content, check out his podcast, check out his books. And are you still doing the daily emails? Do you have something like that still going?
Yep. Daily dose of inspiration. You can sign up at lightwatkins.com.
Love that. Okay, cool. We'll definitely be doing that. Thanks so much for doing this, Light.
Thank you, bro. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
Hey, it's Ben Decker, and I just have to thank you again for listening to the Modern Spirituality Podcast. For information on anything mentioned here, you can check out the show notes below. You can also get in touch with me via twitter.com/BenDecker, instagram.com/BenjaminWDecker, or email me at BenDecker@ModernSpiritualityPodcast.com. It really does mean so much to me that you're here with me on the modern spirituality journey. I'm genuinely super excited about what I've got planned for these next few episodes. So really make sure to subscribe to the Modern Spirituality Podcast so you can get in on what I've got coming up. And if this is resonating for you, if anything here helped or inspired or entertained you at all, please, please do rate this podcast and leave me a review. It means so much more than you might realize. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again.